This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Maya.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblé.
And our topic today is?
This week we don't have one topic. We will have a couple of small topics. And I would like to introduce a new fun rule.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that's a surprise.
I wasn't informed about this.
Yep, that is. I know that you don't have any follow-ups. So let's jump on that surprise rule. So this week it was partly lazy, partly out of inspiration. So I spoke, Yannick and I spoke offline, and we just like were preparing some kind of small talks, like just topics. We don't have much to say, or maybe we have much to say, but not stuff pretty prepared right now. So I wanted to do something pretty funny with those. So I asked Yannick to have a couple of those ready, in quote, and I would like to enforce a special rule when we'll talk about them.
Uh-oh.
So besides me, I have my iPhone inside the stopwatch app. And since we love to blabber, I would like us to stay under 10 minutes per subject.
That's actually pretty good because one of the podcasts I really liked back in the day was the Insert Credit podcast, and it was 10 topics for 6 minutes each for about an hour of gaming discussion. And the first couple episodes where they were really strict about enforcing that 6 minute restriction was really, really great. And then as they started getting softer and softer and started breaking the limit, it got more and more boring, which was kind of disappointing. And now they're just not doing the podcast at all anymore due to unknown reasons. So I really like that kind of restricting time boxing things to actually try and get the essentials out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And this week I was more thinking about that rule and what would be the perfect time limit than thinking about topics to talk. So that was pretty funny. So yeah, so you seem to like that idea, even if you're like a little bit surprised about it, but
we'll see how it turns out.
Yeah, well, let's use the fact that I was lazy over the last 2 weeks to just try something new.
Sounds good. So let's start with you.
Yeah, so first topic I wanted to talk is sadly this week we learned that a Nintendo president, Satoru Iwata, died at 55, and I wanted to talk with you about his legacy.
It's a tragedy, really.
It is. But to be honest, no, I don't, like, everybody's telling that this man is a legend. But I haven't followed Nintendo quite closely in the recent years, so I don't know why.
All right. In the video gaming world, the people who are in charge of the big video game companies very often are business people and are not necessarily gamers who understand what gamers want. Or in the case of Iwata, he was previously a programmer who had actually made games, so he's also very much in touch with issues that are important to developers. So at a certain point, I believe it was around the time that the 3DS was doing really, really poorly after launch, and everybody was saying they're going to have to do layoffs. And Iwata was basically responsible for doing everything in a way so that he could avoid the layoffs at Nintendo. So he cut his own pay significantly. I think it was by half, just so that we could avoid layoffs for developers in Nintendo, because he said, it's ultimately my responsibility that the company is failing. It is not the responsibility of the people who work under me, who are doing a terrific job, except I led them in the wrong direction. So it should be my responsibility. Now, of course, he didn't get fired for that. He just cut his own pay. But yeah, that's part of the reason why people respect Iwata so much. Another thing is there have been a lot of little anecdotes that have come out over the last week. These aren't necessarily new, but things like During the development of Super Smash Bros. Melee, they were getting really, really, really close to deadline, and nobody was basically debugging or code reviewing anything. And Iwata said, well, screw this. I'm the president of Nintendo, but I'm going to go do code review and help out with debugging so that we can get this done in time for the I'm not sure if it was the holidays, but for the deadline, basically. And Super Smash Bros. Became one of the most loved video games ever. I mean, he's touched a lot of video games that have had huge impacts on people. Like, he is a good friend of Shigesato Itoi, which made the Mother series, and Earthbound, which came out here. And he was involved in that. I know that right after the news came out about his death, I went straight ahead and played one of the games he developed when he was much younger, and that was Balloon Fight, which is not necessarily a legendary game, let's just say that, but it's still a very solid one and entertaining enough, I would say.
Yeah, and my main reasoning for asking this question is, like, we know that in the recent year, Nintendo is struggling in the video game market. Like, they found their niche with the Wii, but they had issues to keep that momentum. And, like, I know that, like, he was always seen as a legend, but since I'm not that much in the know in the internal of Nintendo, I was, like, comparing that with all of the news that Nintendo is not doing so great right now, and, like, having a little bit of backstory from the character is pretty interesting, because it explains so much stuff, and I guess it could also explain why Nintendo is kind of still around in its original form, even if they were facing problems, or they still are facing those problems.
Well, I would recommend greatly to go watch his GDC 2011 keynote. I've been meaning to go watch his other keynotes at GDC over the past few years, but I just haven't had the time. But 2011 in particular, he talks about the oncoming threat of social network games and mobile games, and I am convinced that he saw this coming. I'm not sure he reacted in the best way necessarily to those threats, but he was very much aware of them, and he pays attention to what's going on. He's not like a dumbass who's blind and only plays Nintendo games. There have been reports that internally other people are maybe blinded to what happens outside of Nintendo, sort of like how there are reports sometimes from inside Apple who say, well, Apple doesn't really pay attention to what happens outside of Apple. And I think that's sort of a problem in any kind of company with that kind of idolized culture, I would say. But Iwata wasn't a dummy. He knew what was going on. He just maybe didn't make the right choices.
Which always happened in businesses, and that's fine.
Yeah, well, unless they kill the company.
No, yeah, but it seems to me that from all of the backstories we heard recently, in the last few days, is that man was owning his mistakes the best he could.
Yeah, and on top of just what he did with regards to taking care of the company and helping out on projects when it got to crunch time and stuff like that, I think Iwata played a huge role in the outreach to their fans recently, because he was basically the person behind the Nintendo Direct concept, which is, we are giving up on having press conferences at big gaming events. We're going to make these pre-recorded videos, which we're going to live stream on the internet to everyone. And they were basically ahead of everyone else in doing that, because, like, this was before Twitch streaming and stuff, like, before streaming game stuff really became big. And they were like, okay, every couple months we're going to have a Nintendo Direct where we announce basically the next 3 months of games in every region at the same time to our fans. And when there's a Nintendo Direct, if you're following any gamers, the timelines are exploding with, holy shit, Nintendo just did A, B, C, D, and holy shit, new amiibos I have to buy, take all my money.
And exactly, and I would even go as far as to say that even, like, Nintendo's competitor haven't started that trend. Like, yes, they were the first big video game company to do those kinds of, like, big production, recorded, streamed, like, intros of their new products or news. But even, like, Sony or Microsoft haven't, like, jumped in that bandwagon, because I guess they don't see the value of it or whatever.
Well, they sort of do that now. But one of the things that I think Nintendo realized is that the value that there was in gaming magazines in the 90s was there wasn't a direct channel to the consumers. So Nintendo sort of had Nintendo Power, which was sort of their direct channel to the consumers. But they didn't really have a way of saying, here are new games, and control the message entirely. Now they can bypass the press entirely and just stream something officially directly to the fans and not have the intervention of editorial at EGM or whatever and say, because like I think it was EGM in the 90s, they basically wouldn't review Nintendo games for some political reason. And that's sort of not what you want. It's sort of like how retailers would shun Apple products and just not put them in their stores. And that's why Apple stores were very, very important to the revival of the Mac and the iPod, and then eventually iPhone and iPad became really, really important for those things. So I think they're ahead of the curve on that stuff, and they're really smart. And that's part of why I'm very excited to see what they do with DNA on the mobile front.
Maybe it's a little bit early to talk about that, but do you have any maybe thoughts about the future of Nintendo?
It really depends what their next hardware is. I think the future of the company banks, well, it doesn't bank on that because they have sort of mobile as a fallback if everything screws up. And I think they'll make a lot of money on mobile.
Yeah, but they still haven't announced or shipped something with mobile.
We should be hearing about that very soon.
I hope so.
I would imagine by Tokyo Game Show, we're going to have a game in our hands, which is in September. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing what their next hardware is, because they could totally blow it. If they say we need to be backwards compatibility with 3DS, that just locked you out of a whole bunch of possibilities. It's also not clear because the rumors seem to indicate that the next hardware is going to be combination of handheld and console, basically. So maybe sort of like the Wii U, except you can take it out of your house and play with it instead of leaving it on the charging station because it has 3-hour battery.
And now I understand why you said like backward compatibility with the 3DS, right? And not the Wii U. Huh. Interesting.
Right, because if they do that, well, they have to have the same screen resolution, and then you're fucked, because the screen resolution on 3DS is garbage, and you don't want to be stuck with that forever. And far as I can tell, the 3D thing doesn't even allow you to do a sort of easy retina hack where you just double the pixels. I don't think it's that simple if you're doing it the 3D way of things. I could be wrong, but that's my impression. So everything banks on that hardware. It could be VR, who knows? Really, all we know is it has two letters, it has NX, and it's going to be powered under the hood by a DNA-run network that may or may not be good. And that is a big mystery right now, which is why everybody's very much looking forward to next year's E3 to figure out what the hell's going on.
Yeah, and you touched a little bit of... Oh, crap. So, yeah. 10 minutes? Okay, good. I'll just finish my sentence. So, you touched a little bit of VR, which, if I recall correctly, Nintendo's kind of the only big company right now that is not, like, it's not public with their plans about VR. They're just like, we might think that they're doing something. We don't know. It's like,
All they've we'll said see. So far is VR in its current state is not fun. But they said in its current state. They didn't say forever. So if they're working on VR, maybe that is what is going to be making VR fun.
Good.
All right. So I'm going to talk, unsurprisingly, about Apple Music and Beats 1, because it's been 2 weeks since it launched and I've been playing with it for the last 2 weeks, and I want to rant about it significantly. So you might want to start the timer.
Already done.
Okay, so I'm going to start off by talking about Beats 1, because I'm very much in love with Beats 1. I have some recommendations for shows that you should listen to if you are into certain types of music. So note these down. If you are into club music or dance music, Disclosure's show is really, really good. It will already have aired by the time this comes out, so you're going to have to wait another 2 weeks because it's on a two-week schedule.
Is that the Drake show?
No.
Okay.
Disclosure is a garage house band from the UK.
Oh my. Oh, I feel bad for them to compare them to Drake. Okay. Pardon me.
We're going to talk about Drake in a sec. Ellie Goulding, which you might know from featuring vocals on a bunch of pop songs, her show is really, really good. It's Thursday nights at 10 p.m. That is a weekly show. I have not missed one yet, and I don't plan on missing one. Juliet Anuga's show every day is sort of at the juncture between club music and hip hop. So if you are into either of those things, you are probably going to enjoy half of the show at least. So that's really good. Rap Lovers. Basically, there are two big rap shows, in my opinion, on Beats One. There's The Pharmacy with Dr. Dre, which will already have aired by the time you listen to this and is on a 2-week schedule. So wait another 2 weeks. The Pharmacy with Dr. Dre is so good. It is edited really, really well. It's 2 hours of really well-edited history class about rap, basically. It's amazing. If you like rap, you should listen to The Pharmacy with Dr. Dre. And the other one, of course, is Drake's OVO sound, which you thought I was going to give Drake shit because he was terrible at the keynote presentation, but his show is really good.
I would like to mention that you also thought you were about to give him shit for his show.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, I'm going to listen to Drake's show. Hope it's not a disaster like the keynote. And it was really good. The only sort of complaint I have about Drake's show is because Beats One is always on worldwide. The problem is it was a little early for me. It was like 7 p.m. when it aired, and Drake's style of music on that show is what I would consider late night hip hop, which would be best enjoyed around like 10, 11 p.m. And of course it was 10 or 11 p.m. somewhere in the world, but not here. And that's sort of where I see Beats One's flaw being. There are certain types of music that are best enjoyed at certain hours of the day. And because they're doing the 24/7 thing all around the world, it's not ideal all the time. So that is what I have to say about Beats One. I want to talk about For You. For You recommendations are pretty much bullshit for me. And I have confirmed more or less that the reason for that is that the heart buttons in Apple Music do nothing about 75% of the time. And if you want to diagnose your own recommendations, go make a smart playlist in iTunes and say Loved is True. And you will have a nice little playlist of all the songs you've loved. And well, at least that's what it's supposed to be, except it's probably going to be 25% or less of the songs you've actually loved that are going to show up in that list, and that may influence why your recommendations are shit.
That may be fixed in the latest version of iTunes.
It's not.
Okay, then that's not fixed.
In fact, none of the bugs I've had in iTunes have been fixed. None of the iTunes bugs that I've had have been fixed in the latest version of iTunes, and that is really disappointing to me. Like, I'm not kidding. Sometimes I right click on a song and I choose add to playlist, and all the playlists are not mine. I don't know who they are, but someone's gonna have a lot of S Club 7 in their fucking playlists.
Goodness. Oh my goodness. Go on.
I forgot to mention stuff in the Beats One section, so I'll add this here before I go into the big point that bugs me about Apple Music. There's no real schedule for Beats One, so it airs 3 times, but you have to be very, very attentive to figure out when those 3 times are, and they are very packed close together, so that more or less there's 1 time you can listen to it at a same time in your time zone. And that is not good, in my opinion. There is exactly 1 show which you can listen to after the fact on SoundCloud. And they don't advertise this very well, but Soulection, which is a show that airs over the weekend every week on Beats One, was a SoundCloud show before Beats One, and they were acquired. And basically the thing is, 6 days after the show has aired, they will post a version up on SoundCloud. That is brilliant. I would like to see all of the shows on Beats One do that. But for copyright reasons, they probably can't.
Yeah, maybe not on SoundCloud, but they could do that in Beats, like in the radio section of the Apple Music app.
Or in Connect. Which leads me, of course, to they have started posting partial segments of shows on Kinect so that you can listen to them. It's not an exact replacement for listening to the show itself, but it's better than nothing. And interviews with artists are going up on there, which is probably the number one thing you would want to listen to after the fact. So that's good.
Speaking of Kinect, can I jump to make a small comment on it?
Yeah.
So obviously I click on it. I was having the like, can you like the UI where it's a list of people you might want to follow. So I follow a bunch of people and then nothing happened. I was like, okay. And then I kind of realized that all the people I am following aren't on Kinect.
Yeah.
And then I was like in an infinite loop of just going back to the tab and says like, oh, follow people, until I like search for Zane Lowe, added him, went back on another tab and came back to Kinect, and then voila, I had Kinect working. It was like,
yeah, basically only Beats One hosts are posting on Kinect, and artists who are very much in the bag with Apple.
Yeah, exactly. So Kinect is kind of useless right now, except if you really, really enjoyed Beats One, which I won't say that I do, and I won't say that I also hate, but it's just like, I don't care about it that much. Like, it's pretty interesting as a concept, but it's radio. Oh, well.
Yeah. How much time do I have left?
Sometimes.
That's not helpful.
Go on.
Okay. Apple Music basically is unusable for DJs. And this is something that is more or less very well known these days in the DJ community. I want people outside the DJ community to know this. If you're a DJ, your DJ software probably broke when you installed the new iTunes. It should be somewhat fixed with today's update to iTunes. It also, if you want to use any of the features in Apple Music that are worth a damn, you have to turn on iCloud Music Library. And if you turn on iCloud Music Library, any music that you sync that is in your computer's music library and you download on your iPhone, if that song is in the Apple Music catalog, that's a lot of ifs, but if you have that exact combination of thing, which should be a lot of your tracks if you're a mainstream DJ, you can't DJ on your with those tracks on an iOS device anymore, because there is going to be DRM on those tracks, and you can't do shit to get rid of the DRM.
But I thought they are fixing that in the latest version of iTunes to make sure that they're like uploading the right version and like making sure that they match your stuff from iTunes Math.
The issue was not that the DRM was being put and that wasn't supposed to happen. The issue was that basically you turned on Match and then all your metadata went to shit. And that included you would get duplicate tracks like I got, where one is the matched version and one is which resides on your hard drive, and one is this nebulous version from the cloud maybe, and you're not sure what to do with it. And some people were basically, yes, they got the wrong version in their playlists and then their DJ software wouldn't read it, and that's why they thought they had DRM copies. But the fundamental deal is, if you're using Apple Music and you want to use any of the match functionality, if that track is in Apple Music, the streaming service portion of that, when you go to re-download it, it will be DRM'd and you can't do anything with it. Which means iOS DJs can't really do iOS DJing and be on Apple Music at the same time. And that is a tremendous deal breaker for me, so I'm probably not going to renew Apple Music once the trial is over, because I value DJing on iOS that much. And the only part that excites me about the entire service, the only part that arguably works in the entire service, is Beats One, and you don't have to pay for that. I'm not sure if it'll survive if I don't pay for it, which is sort of a problem for me, but that's sort of the situation I'm in right now.
And I think they mentioned that when you, like, if you don't subscribe to Apple Music and you also uses Beats One, you might listen to ad.
It's just the other stations. Beats One is completely ad free.
Okay. I thought it was for all Apple Music radio stuff, but that's fine.
All right, next topic for you.
Good. So today, one of our good friends has been updated.
iTunes?
No, we got new iPod Touch.
Oh,
Right. So today Apple announced and launched new iPod touches.
Yay. And
yes, yay, because those, as far as I know, like I haven't looked that much on into it, but as far as I know, they are still using the same old case from 3 years ago, but they updated all of the internal, like all of the internal. It's like they put most of the iPhone 6 internal inside that tiny iPod Touch.
I read that the loop is missing on this new one.
Yeah, I think that's the only change from the 5th gen to the 6th gen. Yeah. So from the old one, A5-based iPod Touch to this new 64-bit A8-based iPod Touch. Like, the case is all the same. They added new colors and they removed the camera loop.
Yeah.
And we have tons of new configuration, though. We have like size configuration from 16, 32, 64, and 128, which is surprising because the difference between 16 and 32 is $50. Like, everybody's like, we had this debate and this discussion when the iPhone 6 launched, and they were like, oh yeah, they are doing that to make people upgrade. But now with the iPod Touch, like, you can get one for $199 and you'll get 60 gigs of storage, or you can go to the 32 model, which is at $249. And then you're like, why the fuck the 16 model exists? But I'll keep that because, yeah, oh well, we can have that discussion. And yeah, it's kind of sad at the same time, but oh well. So what impresses me is they are able to put the internal of an iPhone 6 inside that smart case, not even 6 months after the launch, or maybe about 8 months into it right now, eight to 10, but like, I'm surprised by it. And this makes me think that the feasibility of having a new iPhone 6S, to call it this way, like a new iPhone this fall that has those same internal with a 4-inch display.
Don't you, like, mean 6C, not S?
Oh, yeah, yeah, pardon me. Yeah, pardon me. Or maybe like a 6S mini, because they'll have the 6S and then the 6 giant S's.
Well, I don't think it would be viable for them to call it a 6S mini if it doesn't have the specs of the 6S. I think they would have to call it the iPhone 6 mini.
Yeah, whatever. But it seems to me that right now, since they are able to do it in a fucking iPod Touch, they'll be able to do, like, I'll be able to keep my 4-inch display size and migrate from my 5S to this new beloved iPhone. And I won't care that much about having the last year's CPU.
Yeah, I'm not really happy about 4-inch devices being basically a second-class citizen. I think that if you're going to do the iPhone thing of, we're announcing all new iPhones this year and we have these sizes, there should be a top model that has parity basically across all those sizes. You could make the case that the iPhone 6 Plus S, or whatever the hell they're going to call it, 6S Plus, that needs more RAM than the 6S does because it has a bigger screen, and I would agree. I think that's a good reason, in the same way that the iPad Air 2 having extra gig of RAM is a perfectly valid reason. But it pisses me off that if you are in the, well, I'm not going to say minority, because who knows if it really is, because they haven't actually given anyone the choice of equal specs on all devices, which one do you actually want? I know if they gave me the option between a 4-inch, 4.7-inch, or 5.5-inch iPhone with all the same specs, I would gravitate toward the 4-inch one.
Yeah, I think so. But you know what? I think what might make me switch is the new hardware features. Because even last year, I was not planning to update, to upgrade to a new iPhone, but I was thinking about what will I do if I was to buy an iPhone 6. Like, will I mine the 6 blocks? And I tried the 6 blocks over Christmas time. And like the main difference is the big screen and the camera, but the camera is way better. Like the iPhone 6 camera is awesome, but the iPhone 6 Plus camera is like magnificent, like automatically taking picture for you. Even it's not that true, but
like, well, okay, hang on. Tell the people who are listening what phone you are currently on and how many years it's been since you have that phone.
Right now I'm on an iPhone 5S and I bought it at its launch.
So almost 2 years now.
Yeah, not at its launch. I bought it a couple of months after its launch. So like it was launched in October and I think I bought it in February of 2014. It was launched in October 2013. Yeah, so nearly 2 years.
Right. So I think that pretty much, like, I was coming from a iPhone, wait, what was it? An iPhone 5 when I bought my iPhone 6. And because it's been 2 years since my last phone, the delta in performance on the camera is so huge that I don't mind the tiny delta that there actually is, that you sort of imagine is bigger between the 6 and 6 Plus. Because, in my opinion, the 6 camera is fantastic. And I know I haven't played very much with the 6 Plus in the ideal conditions for testing this kind of stuff, which is low light, obviously. But like this year when I was in Japan, I was taking photos in clubs with my iPhone 6 that blew my mind. Like, even it outperforms my eyes. It doesn't make sense.
I get that. But I think like my reasoning behind it is, would I consider like keeping a smaller phone with the trade-off of having last year hardware, or just like maybe enjoy the new iPhone with, but having issue with the bigger screen, but having the new hardware. I think that's something I'm still thinking about.
I think it's going to kill me to say this, but if you're a fan of the 4-inch model, you sort of have to get used to the 4.7 at this point.
And I think it's something I need to get used to.
And I mean, like, I've done it, and I'm much more bitchy about this stuff than you are. So I think it's time for you to get on board. I'm still upset whenever I hold my phone and I realize that it's 4.7 inches, but I deal with it because it's an iPhone, and holy shit, it's a good iPhone. The only issue that I have with it is basically that, and Touch ID hates me.
Oh, right. And before I run out of time, I want to talk about our two other friends, the iPod Nano and the iPod Shuffle. And I need to not laugh, because those are funny. So they updated them with new colors and that's it. No hardware change, no capacity change, and that's it. I think now they are maintaining their price. So just like, we were using the same colors as the new iPod Touch. And from what we heard from John Gruber, birdies told him that nobody's working on those iPods right now. Like, all of the people that were working on the iPod software are on the Apple Watch software.
I mean, it makes sense.
It does. It totally does. But it's quite funny. Like, I was looking around to see if those new devices were supporting Apple Music.
No.
Music. And nope. They still don't. So
I doubt that they ever will, honestly.
I'm still surprised that they are getting refreshed, to be honest.
Yeah, well, sure. I agree, but
yeah, it's like, at that point, why not kill those and just keep the iPod Touch, especially when you just launch a new, like, internet-based music service.
Well, there was a rumor back when the last iPod Nanos came out that because they have Bluetooth, they would do some kind of streaming music syncing over Bluetooth to the, well, I guess it was iTunes at that point, similarly to how the Apple Watch can sync Apple Music tracks off of your iPhone. So it wouldn't be unheard of for them to support Apple Music with a software update or something like that. But the problem is, if no one's working on it, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Don't forget that especially the iPod Nano still has this fake iOS
6 UI.
It's so lovely.
I think I should buy you one.
Yes, you should.
I'll just go to the Apple store like over the weekend.
And I want
like
a pink one, okay?
Okay, okay. Oh, and we'll end on that, I guess. Good, awesome. But yeah, I think I'll just go to the Apple store and say like, yep, yeah, I heard that you get the new iPod Nanos. I'll take all of them. All of the pink one.
All right. So next topic is going to be a little surprising to you probably, and it's because it's JRPG July this month, which is a thing that Anne Lee, who writes at a blog called Chic Pixel, does is every month. Basically, she has a theme on her blog, and everyone who reads her blog basically plays games in that theme. And this month is JRPG July, which means everybody is playing a bunch of JRPGs. And first, before I go into anything specific, I want to ask you what your experience with JRPGs are.
My last experience with a JRPG is, and if I'm not mistaken, Persona 4 Gold Edition on the Vita.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, because I think Zelda is considered the RPG, not the JRPG, even if it's made from Japan.
Zelda is not even really an RPG.
Too, so yeah. And I also recently bought, but I haven't played it yet, Final Fantasy X and X2 Remake for the PS3.
Oh, you finally bought it.
Yeah, I bought it pretty cheap at some local video game store.
Nice.
Remember when I bought Uncharted for the Vita for like $10? Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I bought it there.
Nice. Basically, I want to talk about JRPGs because if there is a defining characteristic about JRPGs, it's that they're very, very, very long. And as we've become adults, we have less time to spend playing video games in theory. And ideally, you want to make the best use of that time. And recently, I've been thinking which JRPGs are really worth playing, that basically the amount of time you put in it, the reward you get out of the story and whatnot, balances out. Because you don't want to play an entire JRPG for 30, 40, 80, 100 hours and then realize that the entire thing is bullshit. And I'm lucky enough to be basically in a video game community which has a lot of smart people who have played a lot of video games that can recommend these games to me. I'm personally playing Final Fantasy IV this month because it's... I asked a lot of people what Final Fantasies they consider to be the ones that best define the series. And the answers I got was basically 4, 7, 12... and that sort of it. They basically said, like, play those three, you're good. And, I mean, it sort of makes sense because Final Fantasy IV basically captures the Super Nintendo era Square, which apparently is the peak of when Square made the best RPGs, and they kept pumping out great RPGs every couple months or so. And you can just more or less spend the rest of your life playing Square SNES RPGs and be very content with your gaming life. Final Fantasy VII, of course, it is perhaps legendary amongst Final Fantasy fans. And more or less, Final Fantasy recently has boiled down to please remake Final Fantasy VII is the first thing that anyone would say if they were the first in line for a Final Fantasy launch in Japan. Like, they would have this big event where the first person in line for the game would get to, like, shake the hand of the person who made it, and every single goddamn time, the first thing out of their mouths is, please remake Final Fantasy VII. So they finally will be.
Yeah, they are finally will be.
And Final Fantasy XII, which is incredibly polarizing because it features a system called Gambits, where you can program your party members to automatically fight according to rules. And that just attracts me, being a programmer, and I really want to try that out. But it's incredibly polarizing because apparently a bunch of people don't like that shit because they're not programmers. So, I mean, it makes sense.
It totally does.
So those three are sort of on my list of things to play. But right now I'm playing Final Fantasy IV because I said, no, I might as well just do them chronologically. And I'm really, really enjoying it. But the strange thing is, it's a 37-hour game, in theory, according to howlongtoplay.com, which is a website that basically gathers how long it took people to play a certain game. 37 hours to beat the main story is what it says, and only the main story.
So bad when they say that. Like, I was looking at restart my save game in Persona 4, because obviously, like last time I played 2, this game is like at least a year and a half ago. And that's my main roadblock. It's like, and especially in Persona 4, it's like, right now I'm playing Zelda, and it's pretty okay. Like, I can, like, stop play for a couple of days and go back into it pretty easily. You cannot do that in Persona 4. You can't.
No, basically you have to take, like, the entire week of your life is just playing that dungeon. Well, maybe the dungeon won't take a week. I think you can probably do one in, like, 2 or 3 days of playing every night. But, like, you have to know what you're planning to do.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, most of the Final Fantasy game is kind of the same. Like,
well, what I'm enjoying a lot about Final Fantasy IV is how it's basically the perfect handheld or commute game where everything is sort of in a chunk of 30 to 40 minutes. And if you finish that chunk, you basically know the next destination you have to go to. And next time you pick up your thing, you can just go to that place and do that thing. And 30 to 40 minutes later, you're out of there and you can do that every day. So it actually goes quite well to get through the game. And the thing I was thinking about was, how long to play says 37 hours. I'm at 97% through the game and I'm at 14 hours and a half. And I'm like, wait a second, this is my first time playing the game. I'm not speedrunning it. I'm like playing and I'm sucking at the game even sometimes. And I'm like, it doesn't make sense. I'm at the final dungeon right now. And I mean, I have like, there are probably like 7, 8, 9 bosses in that dungeon, but it's not going to get me to 37 hours. I doubt it even gets me to 20 hours. So yeah, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about that recently. Are long games really worth it for adults to play? And if so, which ones are? If not, shouldn't we be playing more Nintendo-like games, which Nintendo more or less has an average completion time of 6 to 11 hours on their games, I would say. And that seems a lot more approachable to me.
Oh, it does. It does. And now that you mentioned like the completion time of a game, I was reminding myself of when I played The Last of Us. And I'm still trying to find, to find time to replay it. And I remember when I immersed myself in it, I was like, oh, it went too fast. Like, it was a short game, and people were saying, yes, it's a short game, but it's a really, really awesome one. And I think I will like that if I want to just replay the story again.
Well, it makes me think of Portal, which Portal was basically, I think it was a 4-hour game or something like that. I mean, I know I went to a friend's house and I beat it, like, in 2 trips to his house.
Yeah, so I guess, like, having games that are having shorter completion time is way easier to just do, like, video games and real-life balance.
Yeah. Which is sort of a problem, because I actually like JRPGs, except I can't really get myself to play them if it's going to take me forever to actually beat it.
Totally agree with you on that.
So, are you going to be picking up Persona 4 again for JRPG July now that I've mentioned it?
Oh, that's a good question. Because my original plan right now is to beat Zelda Majora's Mask.
Oh.
And I think I wanted to play, I wanted to go play the boring Uncharted on Vita, because everybody's like, you'll hate it. So, but I paid $10 Canadian for it, so I don't care.
You're a masochist. So, you're going to go play Uncharted on the Vita.
Yeah, so I'll play it because I really love the PS3 game, and just like, I'm sure, you know what, I'm knowing myself, I'm sure I'll just be like, oh, it's not that good, not that bad, but I spent like a fun time playing it, and that will be probably it.
Yeah, recently I've been looking at my backlog of games that I have, and I use a website called Backloggery to archive all of that. And basically any game that I tried for an hour that I didn't rate at least 3 stars, I basically canceled it and said, I'm never going to play this because it's not good enough. A lot of 3-star games basically dropped off my list because I was like, I have way too many 4-star and 5-star games to actually finish getting through, that I'm going to do those first and then maybe revisit these games. And I'm pretty pleased with my decision. Like, there is a lot of shit I bought on Steam that I don't actually want to play.
There's a lot of stuff I bought on Steam that I won't play because I don't have a Windows PC.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, that's a problem with Steam. That's why I plan on never installing it again. Because you know what? Every time I install it, it is during their like Steam sale. Like, it happens every 3 months, and I'm like, oh, spending so much money, and then yeah, so much money is like $10 because you can get tons of games for $10.
Yeah.
But it's just games that I won't do anything with them. It's just they are sitting there. I would need to play them with a VM or with WAN or other stuff, and this is never going to happen.
Yeah.
So I guess it's free money for the devs.
Yeah. So let's move on to your next topic.
Which is kind of non-existent, to be honest.
Oh.
Maybe the last subject I would like to talk with you, and we'll end on that, is let's call it our collective thinking of moving more of our code to Swift, or maybe coding more stuff in Swift. Because you touched on that, and I want to finally update my last personal computer that is not yet updated to the latest OS, and do that in the coming weeks to be able to use the latest Xcode and play with Swift even more. Because I haven't watched much of the new dubdub session related to the Swift stuff that I didn't attend, but I got through some part of like intro to the new Swift 2.0. I was like, I think that's the right one to start working on. Like, I think with Swift 2.0, it is the right time to start learning it for real and not like every 3 months I have to relearn mostly everything in the language because everything has changed.
Yeah. I'm tempted to ask, how often do you use third-party code in your projects? Because that is sort of the issue with Swift right now.
In my personal project, it's pretty rare because sometimes it's just try to do stuff, and I think it's mostly the same at work. Like, we are pretty conservative. We use quite a lot, but we try to evaluate it properly and make sure that it's the right compromise between dev time to create our own version or dev time to maintain third party code.
Okay, let me explain sort of my issue with Swift right now, and it has nothing to do with the actual language or with integration with Objective-C. It has everything to do with third-party libraries, because as I explained on the EOS episode, my new apps are going to depend more on third-party code, and I'm starting to regret that decision already.
I'm not surprised.
So basically the two main dependencies that I'm using are Alamo Fire for doing network requests, and SwiftyJSON, which takes all of the pain out of using JSON in Swift, which is incredibly painful if you are not using some sort of framework like that. And the issue is the code written in Swift that you import, which is third-party libraries and all that stuff, needs to be in the same Swift version that your app is using, which means until Alamo Fire and SwiftyJSON are updated to Swift 2.0, I can't use them in my Swift 2.0 app, which means I can't develop iOS 9 stuff until they are done.
And at least, are they using Swift 1.2? Or are they still lacking on that?
Swift 1.2, yeah, it works.
Okay.
There is probably a branch for Swift 2. I'm not going to lie. But you wonder, is that branch really mature enough for production right now, given that Swift 2 isn't actually going to be out officially until the OS is out and everybody ships their app at the same time? And it's sort of a problem. Especially because they don't guarantee source compatibility. So you can't actually go grab Alamo Fire and SwiftyJSON and just compile them on Swift 2, because if they introduced anything new in the language or changed anything in the language, and they did, you are going to have warnings. And if you don't know what that code does, you might not make the right choice when trying to adapt it to be Swift 2.
Yeah, you might end up breaking it. And yes. If there's no way for you to know that you broke something. Like, a good example of that is having tests. And if there's no test run, you don't know you have broke something, and you don't want to do the manual test of that third-party library because you have time. You want to use your time for anything else.
Well, that's another issue. Is basically Swift was basically untestable in Xcode until this year.
What do you mean?
There were a lot of things in the XC test framework which did not work with the Swift test system.
Oh, right. Okay,
type
yeah.
system.
Yeah.
And the problem is, if you're trying to test Swift libraries, that is not good. So you basically also had to wait for the test framework to finish up grading to Swift 2 so that then you can update the tests and update the third-party library so that you can test if the third-party library works, and it's a goddamn mess.
No, and I think, you know, like you, in the last episode when you spoke about your experience with EOS, you mentioned that you're trying to create maybe some generic frameworks of stuff you can easily reuse on different project of your own. So yeah. Maybe those libraries or frameworks could be in Swift, because that is code you want to spend time to maintain, but you will still want to use the OBJ interoperability with third-party code and your code that is specific for a certain project.
Right, but then if I'm doing that, I'm not using the features of Swift that make Swift appealing, so I might as well just write Objective-C.
You're totally right on that, but at the same time, the more you use it, and the more you'll learn how to make it work properly, and also, like, it will give you more knowledge, and it will make you more capable in the future. So you won't be able to say to yourself, like, oh, I'm so slow in Swift, so I won't use Swift. But well, if I don't use Swift, I will still be slow. It'll break that cycle.
Well, I don't think I'm slow in Swift. That's not part of the issue.
Okay, the issue is more compared to Objective-C.
I don't even think that's really a thing yet.
Okay.
Because I've been working basically exclusively in it for 3 months now. So it's not too bad. But what comes to mind is, even Objective-C code, which if I were to import that into my project, they can update the Objective-C code to support the new stuff that they introduced as part of Swift 2 in Objective-C, and then my Swift code breaks. So it doesn't actually solve anything.
Oh, now okay, now I get it. Oh, I see. Okay.
Because yeah. If they add the non-nullable stuff and all of that stuff, now I'm forced to use Swift 2. Now, if you have one framework which uses Swift 2 and one framework that doesn't, you can't do that because they all need to be on the same version of Swift.
Yeah, and obviously you cannot link on two Swift libraries at the same time, which is no. Like crazy.
Yeah. So okay. you sort of see the issue there is, even if you go with Objective-C, you basically have to commit to a version that is before Swift 2 if you want it to work.
So are you trying to tell me that I should reconsider my idea of upgrading my iMac to use Swift?
No, I think Swift is really, really interesting to play with, and there are a lot of cool things you can do with it that you can't do in Objective-C, and it's also nice to have. I mean, like, it's easy to shit on the stricter type system because it doesn't allow for all of the stuff that is making me money right now, but it's also really nice to have a stricter type system which gives you better errors for and can prevent a whole bunch of errors from happening. It's still possible to cheat the system a bit and still have errors. And I really, really, really can't wait for every single goddamn framework to be audited so that I don't have to deal with optionals that are not optional and stupid shit like that. Like, Objective-C frameworks have gone a long way towards being Swift-friendly, but they're not all there yet. And I really want them to be, because as soon as I can stop worrying about whether or not the thing I'm receiving is actually an optional or not, a whole bunch of my code can disappear.
Okay. So you still are convincing me to keep up my original plan of finally...
I think it's better for you to play with it and be upset than to not play with it.
Sounds like a plan.
I mean, that's what I'm doing. I'm using it in production in all my apps, and it's probably going to be a horrible idea, but I want to learn this stuff because it's going to be valuable to the future of the platform, and if we want to continue working on that platform, it's in our best interest to actually learn it.
Couldn't agree more on that.
You have anything to say?
Nope. Hey, for the first time tonight, we're before the clock.
Yay! Yeah. And we are under an hour, which is amazing.
It is. It is. To be honest, though, even if, like, I'm pretty proud of my laziness right now. Because you know what? I don't think for Limitless it will be a good idea to have, like, every 2 weeks this kind of show. But once in a while, we are just out of ideas, out of imagination, and we just press record and just do that.
Yeah, well, next week's episode is going to have a lot of imagination and might be very long, so I'm going to warn everyone ahead of time for that. And I'm going to have to give you your homework at some point this weekend so that you can do it.
Oh, that's the homework episode.
Yes. So the next episode, I'm going to be giving Nukativi 4 albums from a specific genre that I enjoy, a musical genre that I enjoy, and he's going to have to listen to them entirely from one end to the other.
Oh, man.
And tell me what he thinks of them.
Oh, man. You know what? I'm sure those albums are so long. Like, they are
No, they're
lengthy.
Not. They're not. They're not.
Okay.
Don't worry about it.
I'm surprised. I was like, I'm sure he's going to give me lengthy albums.
Well, no, they're not that bad. I don't think so.
Okay.
At least 3 of them are not that bad.
Last question before wrap up. Are they on Apple Music?
No, they're not.
Crap.
But they are all available for download for free, so I'll send you links.
Ooh, I'm intrigued now.
Yeah. It's the future of music, man. Don't have to pay for anything. All right. Good.
So before we transform into a long show, let's wrap this up.
Yeah. So you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Socarina.
And you can find me on Twitter at Lukonush. You can find the show on Twitter at Limipo_podcast. That's LIMIPO_podcast. And you can find the lack of show notes at limitlesspossibility.net/19. I'm sure we'll just post a couple of links, but yeah, lack of show notes for this week.
All right.
And see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.